And I think it's a good way to go about doing that. So I can just reply to it, and then you have the answers in written form as well. So make sure if you have questions, you're doing that if you're not coming to the chat room. So we've been talking about enzymes, and on Monday it was basically we introduced them as biological catalysts, which are extremely specific, and they act as catalysts, so they're not consumed in a reaction. But instead, they lower the energy of activation for biological reactions, allowing us to more effectively convert substrate to product. We also talked about their kinetics in terms of Michaelis-Menten and Lineweaver-Burke. We defined VE, Vmax, KM, substrate concentration. And then we also talked about inhibitors of enzymes, and in particular competitive inhibitors, which are important to the pharmaceutical industry, because competitive inhibitors compete directly for the active site on the enzyme. So they fill the active site, and then the substrate can't bind. So today we're going to talk about a couple of different types of enzymes, and in particular isozymes and non-functional plasma enzymes. And then we're also going to introduce the concept of regulation. So what isozymes are is enzymes that catalyze the exact same reaction, but they are physically and chemically distinct in different tissues. So basically, in, say, the liver and the pancreas, the enzyme will catalyze the exact same reaction, but the enzyme that comes out of the liver or comes out of the pancreas are distinctly different, chemically different, separable on electrophoresis. And what this does is it gives us the ability to identify enzymes coming from different tissues. And we're going to see in a minute why that would be important. Non-functional enzymes, plasma enzymes, are kind of similar, except that they have no real function, no biological function, and we don't know why. It can be a variety of things. Maybe they don't have the correct cofactors they need, or the cofactors are too dilute. The enzyme concentrations may be too low for them to be biologically functioning. But what they do is they, again, appearance of such enzymes tell us what tissue, and in particular what cell type, these enzymes come out of, and it allows us to determine if we see non-functional plasma enzyme levels rise in the plasma, we can tell what organ or what particular cell type is damaged. And so again, it's a good, useful tool for a clinician when trying to diagnose something. And the principal enzymes used clinically, you have a list of them here. Some of these are isozymes, and some of them are non-functional plasma enzymes. So I'm going to tell you which ones are the isozymes, and you should put an I by them so that you will know. Alkaline phosphatase, the third one down, alkaline phosphatase, that is an isozyme, alkaline phosphatase. AST, which we're going to talk about in great detail, aspartate aminotransferase, is an isozyme. Amylase is an isozyme. Creatine phosphokinase, fourth up from the bottom, is an isozyme. And LDH, also known as lactate dehydrogenase, is an isozyme. The other enzymes in this list are non-functional plasma enzymes. And we won't spend quite as much time talking about those as we will the isozymes, which we'll go into some detail about. So basically, the test for prostate cancer, which most men get routinely, I think it's over the age of 50, depending on history and so on, measures for the non-functional plasma enzyme called acid phosphatase. And the reason acid phosphatase would be present in the serum at increased or above normal levels would be because cells in the prostate, for some reason, are damaged or dying at more significant rates than usual. And so that sometimes is an indication of some kind of carcinoma or problem with the prostate. So again, a way a non-functional plasma enzyme would be used is its presence, the mere fact that it is present in the serum, tells us there's some kind of organ damage or cellular damage going on. Cells are lysing. And when they lyse and die, they spill out their contents. And that's where these non-functional plasma enzymes come from. ALP, which is alanine aminotransferase. People with liver disease present with pretty much the same symptoms all around, and that is they tend to be jaundiced, which simply means they're yellow in color, and they have various complaints. But then the key to that is to figure out, well, what exactly is wrong with the liver. Alanine aminotransferase is a non-functional plasma enzyme that shows up when, in particular, a patient has hepatitis. You will also notice further down in the line, there's glutamyl transpeptidase. That's a non-functional plasma enzyme which shows up for liver disease other than hepatitis. So in other words, if a person presents to you as a clinician with some sort of jaundice with obvious liver function problems, this begins to allow you to diagnose, well, is it hepatitis or is it something else? And again, these non-functional plasma enzymes are coming out of the liver cells, out of the hepatocytes, which are lysing due to one problem or another. Either it's disease or tumor or something that is causing them to spill out their contents into the blood. Alkaline phosphatase is an isozyme, and it is significant for bone disorders. It's also seen in liver disease, again, when there's some kind of obstruction, say, in the bile duct from the liver. So again, that helps in diagnosing a very general clinical symptom that we call jaundice and liver problems. We can begin to kind of hone down on what exactly is wrong with the liver. Aspartate aminotransferase, creatine phosphokinase, and lactate dehydrogenase are the three enzymes that appear after a heart attack or myocardial infarction, and we will talk about them in some detail. Amylase is an enzyme that is in saliva, among other places, pretty much everywhere, and it allows us to begin to digest carbohydrates. It shows up if we have a problem with our pancreas. Ceruloplasmin is a non-functional plasma enzyme. It's specific for a disease called Wilson's disease. And then finally, the last one, lipase, is another pancreatic non-functional plasma enzyme that would show up in the plasma if you had acute pancreatitis, meaning something, again, still fairly general, but is wrong with the pancreas. So we're beginning to pinpoint what organ, what cells are lysing, and then to figure out why, what is wrong there. Is it disease? Meaning something like cancer or just an infection or a tumor or what? Yeah. AST is aspartate aminotransferase, myocardial infarction. We'll look at that in detail. That is an isozyme. So again, the reason these are interesting enzymes is because they allow us to begin to determine sources of disease. And three really important ones for an actually too common problem, three isozymes are creatine phosphokinase, lactate dehydrogenase, and aspartate aminotransferase, which we will talk about in order. So creatine phosphokinase, basically what it does is it catalyzes the reaction or the conversion of something called creatine to phosphocreatine. And basically this is a muscle fuel creatine, and it converts it to phosphocreatine using ATP. And basically anybody who is weightlifters or really into bodybuilding have heard of creatine and phosphocreatine, the things that people take, particularly when they're doing weightlifting, to give their muscles a little extra energy, allow them to keep going, do more weightlifting, build more muscle. But what's more important is it is an isozyme, and it is particular to three different tissues. So it's a tissue-specific isozyme. It's a dimer. It has a muscle and a brain subunit. And if we see, again, it catalyzes the exact same reaction in all the tissues, the muscle, the brain, the heart, same reaction, creatine to phosphocreatine. But if we see creatine phosphokinase at high levels in the plasma, we can then distinctly separate these, because remember, they're chemically different, and we can determine whether it's the MM isozyme, the BB isozyme, or the MB isozyme. And clearly, if it's the muscle isozyme, probably someone's worked out too hard, has a muscle tear, some sort of injury. Brain isozyme has some kind of abnormality in the brain. And most importantly, as we'll see in a minute, and also in the case study, the MB fraction, that isozyme, is indicative of heart cell damage. So cardiac muscle cells are lysing, and that indicates some sort of heart attack. Either the patient's having or had a heart attack. Lactate dehydrogenase. This catalyzes a reaction that we will see when we talk about the glycolytic pathway. So in the last, 3 weeks, we're going to talk about carbohydrate pathways. And it converts pyruvate to lactate, pyruvate to lactic acid. This is something you've all built up in muscle at one time or another, large muscles. If you do too much exercise, strenuous exercise, you build lactic acid. This is the enzyme that catalyzes that reaction. Again, it's tissue-specific, and this one has actually, it's a tetramer of two subunits, an H and an M. If in the plasma we find high levels of the H4 isozyme, that is indicative that there is a problem with the cardiac muscle again, the heart. This H4 isozyme tells us that there's something wrong with an aerobic muscle, a muscle that requires oxygen to live, hence the heart, and again, it is indicative of a heart attack. The M4 isozyme is indicative of muscle. Again, if you overdo in exercising the anaerobic muscles, the large muscle groups, those that don't require oxygen, you will start to see the M4 isozyme. Because if you work out to a certain extent, you will actually start to damage the muscle cells. And of course, again, as they lyse, they're spilling out these contents into the plasma. So we can actually see those. Amylase, again, really general isozyme. It's a monomer. Again, it's in the saliva and pretty much all other tissues. And it helps us to digest starch, which is really the major food source for most of the world's population. They eat starch of some sort, carbohydrates, which is broken down into glucose molecules. And it's glucose that our cells can use in the glycolytic pathway, glucose, fructose, galactose. They convert it to ATP to get energy. However, the pancreas, where we also find amylase in the salivary glands, pancreas, everywhere, absence of the pancreatic amylase tells us that there's something wrong with the pancreas. We have pancreatic dysfunction of some sort. So any kind of symptoms of pancreatic problems, we look for that enzyme. And if it's not there in this case, then we worry about that. So myocardial infarction is a really good example of how we use isozymes. And first of all, basically what a myocardial infarction is that over time, plaque builds in the coronary arteries. It does that in everybody. There's no avoiding it. As one ages, a bit of plaque builds in arteries. Some people faster than other people. Women tend to be protected from it while in the presence of estrogen. So before they go through menopause. But it begins to build in the arteries. Well, once it gets thick enough and a clot goes through the arteries, a fairly somewhat regular event, it can get blocked, stuck in there. So basically the flow gets stopped. And what happens is the cardiac muscle is heavily dependent on blood flowing, on hemoglobin with oxygen, carrying oxygen. So the minute that stops and there's no more oxygen coming, then the heart muscle begins to die. And so the cardiac cells begin to lyse and spill out their contents. Now clearly, depending on the blockage and how fast it's opened, if it's opened in time, the cardiac damage can be very, very mild, or it can be severe and fatal. So there's a time period there, and it has to do with how many arteries and different things that go on. But in all cases, if you've had a heart attack or a myocardial infarction, there will be some lysing of cardiac cells. Well, as soon as that happens and you have symptoms, and we're going to talk more about the symptoms and stuff in the case study, you will see the MB fraction and creatine phosphokinase, the H4 isozyme from lactate dehydrogenase, and you will see aspartate aminotransferase in the blood. Notice in the little graph, the first guy you see actually is the MB fraction, the heart fraction, the one that indicates cardiac cell of creatine phosphokinase. It usually appears within the first 24 hours. So if someone presents with symptoms and one suspects a heart attack, we can look for that, and within the first 24 hours we'll see it. It goes back to normal really quickly. Notice lactate dehydrogenase then persists for a couple weeks. So it starts out and persists. And so basically, several days, lactate dehydrogenase, the H4, which remembers the cardiac isozyme, is present for a couple of weeks. And aspartate aminotransferase will come out at a couple of days, and it usually goes back down to normal by about 4 days. So we can measure these and continue to measure them and watch the progress by looking at the concentrations of these enzymes for diagnosing myocardial infarction. So very useful example of how we use isozymes, particularly clinically. We will see these three again also in a moment. So again, non-functional plasma enzymes really don't have any function except that when they are present in high levels, they indicate some sort of tissue damage. And depending on a particular non-functional plasma enzyme, we can start to narrow down where the problem is. Isozymes, pretty much similar, although isozymes are tissue-specific enzymes which catalyze the exact same reaction in every tissue. But from every tissue, the enzyme is different chemically. So we can actually separate in electrophoresis. So we can actually see the MM versus the MB versus the BV fractions. We can see the H4 versus the M4. So we know which one we're looking at because they're very different. They have different molecular weights, different structure. Again, we can separate them out on electrophoresis. So non-functional plasma enzymes, isozymes. We'll talk about them again in just a minute. Now the concept of regulation. The minute we start to talk about enzymes, metabolic pathways, biochemical reactions, the concept of regulation begins to come up. And everything in the body tends to be very specific, as are enzymes, and also highly regulated. So the body's quite efficient. There's no waste. Things don't go on. Things aren't made. Reactions don't occur that aren't needed. So everything is regulated. And there's some particular types of regulation that we're going to encounter over and over again. So I want you just to start to be familiar with them. The simplest type of regulation, the one we'll see most often, is called substrate availability. That's the most simple. That simply means if the substrate is not around, the enzyme will not be active. So the enzyme is active. The enzyme's activity is determined solely by the concentration of its substrate. So if its substrate is there, the enzyme becomes active. It realizes it needs to convert it to product. That's the simplest form. Allosteric regulation. That's basically how a non-competitive inhibitor works. Remember, we talked about non-competitive inhibitors. Allosteric regulation is something binds to an enzyme somewhere other than at the active site. So as the picture shows, it basically wedges itself in, not in the active site, but somewhere else on the enzyme. And that causes the enzyme to be tense. So the same terms that we used when we talked about hemoglobin, when hemoglobin had oxygen bound, it was relaxed. When it doesn't, it's tense. When an allosteric inhibitor binds, it causes the enzyme to be tense, and it loses affinity for its substrate. So that is how it regulates an enzyme. It binds to it, it loses affinity for its substrate, which slows down the conversion of substrate to product. Substrate can't bind as well. The enzyme doesn't have the affinity, the desire to bind the substrate. Post-translational modification. Basically, the DNA is storing all of our genetic information, passing along messenger RNA. We get synthesis of proteins. All of our enzymes are proteins. And they are modified in the Golgi apparatus after they're synthesized. And there are a number of post-translational modifications that occur as methods of regulation. And what post-translational modification means is attachment of some sort of chemical group to the enzyme, which causes it to slow down or lose affinity for substrate. And the first example is the most common one that we'll see, and that's phosphorylation. We're going to see lots of enzymes being phosphorylated and dephosphorylated. Very common type of regulation. Acylation. You can actually attach an acyl group to the hydroxyl group on, say, a serine or threonine residue on the enzyme. That is a form of regulation. Hydroxylation. There are a couple of enzymes, not too many, that the proline and the lysine on the enzymes can become hydroxylated, OH groups added. Another form of regulation. We can glycosylate. We know what that means. We study glycosylation. It's attachment of a sugar unit It's another form of modification. ADP ribosylation is a fairly complex thing where we actually take an adenine diphosphate molecule and attach it to an enzyme. We will see a couple of examples of this. It makes a very complicated structure. It's a form of regulation of an enzyme. We can also carboxylate an enzyme. So basically, these are the examples of the types of chemical modifications that fall under what we call post-translational modification. So phosphorylation, acylation, hydroxylation, glycosylation, ADP ribosylation, and carboxylation. They all have a kind of ation at the end. So they're all things chemically that we can do to modify enzymes. Next type, and this is a fairly common type of regulation as well, is called interaction with control proteins. And the example of your picture here is protein kinase A. Protein kinase A is an important enzyme for G proteins. For enzymes or hormones like glucagon, which we'll actually see next semester. And protein kinase A exists as a large enzyme with two subunits. One of the subunits is catalytic and one is regulatory. And when those two subunits, which in your picture is the black one and the white one with notches in it, are attached to each other, the enzyme is inactive. It's just sitting poised, ready to go. When some signal occurs, and in the case in your picture, it is a molecule binds to the regulatory subunit, then they split. So the regulatory subunit moves away, and the catalytic subunit moves over here. At that point, the catalytic subunit becomes active. So we now have active protein kinase A. When the enzyme is no longer needed, what happens is these little triangles will go out, and the two subunits will reattach, and the enzyme again will become inactive. So when the regulatory subunit's attached to the catalytic subunit, the enzyme is inactive. When they separate, catalysis can begin. Because remember, that's what an enzyme does, it's catalysis. So the catalytic subunit is the enzyme, the active enzyme, where it binds substrate and converts it to product. So this coming together and breaking apart, coming together, coming apart, is the regulation. So again, it's interaction with a control protein, that's what it's called. But it's basically regulatory and catalytic subunits coming together, coming apart, coming together, coming apart. Fairly common. Zymogens. Lots of enzymes are synthesized as zymogens. And basically what that is the example you see is trypsinogen. Another one is chymotrypsinogen. There are a number of others, trypsin being the active enzyme. And when the enzyme is formed, again, it is a large protein. And for it to become active, there has to be proteolysis. So a piece of the enzyme has to be cut off, hydrolyzed, pushed aside, proteolysis. We need to break peptide bond and lose a piece of the protein for the enzyme to be active. And lots of enzymes are this way, particularly pancreatic enzymes. And the pancreas is the big area for digestion and absorption of fats and carbohydrates. That's a lecture, again, that we cover next semester. A lot of absorption, digestion. And so those enzymes are always poised and ready in case, for instance, we eat and something needs to be digested. So something like trypsinogen is always ready, so we don't have to go all the way back to the genetic level when we need it and go through the DNA transcription, translation, all of that. Activation. It's ready to go, but it's not active because we don't want waste. And it only becomes active when it's needed. And the way it's activated is via proteolysis, which means lysis of a protein, lysis of a peptide bond. So breaking it. That's the last sort of regulation that I wanted you to kind of start to be familiar with. And again, we're going to see all of these types of regulation as we move through the various pathways. So again, substrate availability, allosteric attachment of some group to the enzyme at a site other than the active site, post-translational modification, interaction with control proteins, and zymogens. This last chart is just for you to kind of look at. You don't need to memorize it by any means. It gives you an idea of a number of the amino acids and what modifications can be made to them. This is talking about post-translational modification. So it gives you an idea there are a lot of chemical things that can be done, a lot of modifications that can be made depending on which amino acid you're talking about. For instance, tyrosine can be iodinated or phosphorylated as a means of regulation. Proline can be hydroxylated or glycosylated, for instance. Glutamine can go through deamination or become a pyroglutamate of some sort. So there's lots of different chemical modifications that go on biochemically in terms of regulation. So again, you don't have to memorize those, but you can look that there are, for a number, most all of the amino acids, different forms or types of regulation in terms of post-translational modification. So the protein is made or synthesized, and then, of course, it's modified. So case study 2 was a case study involving just enzymes in general, and in particular the enzyme is lactase, which breaks down lactose. And if lactose is not broken down before it gets down into the lower intestines, then it will be digested by bacteria which live there. And when bacteria digest things, so when things don't get digested up in the upper reaches in the stomach and the pancreas and so on and so forth, and they get down there, the bacteria, as they're digesting things, produce methane and sulfur compounds. In other words, they produce gas and diarrhea. So basically, if your lactose is not digested before it gets to the lower intestine, then you get symptoms of what we call lactose intolerance. This case study involves a 53-year-old male, a banker, doesn't make too much difference, but presented to the ER on Saturday evening, and he complained his left shoulder, his arm, and his neck were hurting. He played a pickup football game, and he thinks he may have run a little bit more than he's used to and might have hurt himself. However, and this is kind of key, he tried different positions and heat, and he probably took painkillers, aspirin, ibuprofen, Excedrin, something, and he could not find any position or any way to relieve or reduce the pain, and the pain continued to get worse. He now also feels weak and sweaty. So when he presents in the ER, the clinician calls sweaty mildly diaphoretic. It's the same word as sweaty. He's not in obvious distress, meaning he's not writhing on the floor. His vital signs are stable, except his heart's beating a little bit fast, 123 beats per minute. Another key, he moves his joints, palpitates his shoulder, his neck, everything, full range of motion, and he's not screaming in pain when he does that. Lungs are clear, abdomen soft, doesn't hear any heart murmurs. So basically they do a lab exam, probably also an EKG, blood count, electrolytes, urinalysis, everything normal. When they look at the plasma and they look at the total creatine kinase, they see that it's really, really greatly elevated, 4,552 normal level, less than 190. The MB fraction in particular they look at, which again is easy to do because remember the MB is easily separable from the MM and the BB fraction. It comprised about 18% of the total, and normal should be about 4 to 6%. So basically, the guy is having a heart attack, myocardial infarction. Now notice that he did not present with crushing chest pain. That's not uncommon. So lots of people are having heart attacks that do not have crushing chest pain. They call that referred pain. It's often in the chest, the neck, the shoulder, as this guy describes. For women, it's often in the jaw. They often have jaw pain, unexplained jaw pain. But again, the kind of the key there in diagnosing it was he couldn't relieve it in any way. So usually, you know, everyone here has pulled a muscle or sprained an ankle or done something, and there's some way you can sit or put it or put heat on it or put ice on it or take enough Excedrin that you can make it stop. But this you can't, because it's not just, you know, that he pulled a muscle. He's actually having a heart attack. Additional studies, basically things like EKG, now probably routinely angiography, to figure out where is the blockage, hopefully open it up. How did the creatine kinase isozymes help? Well, again, first of all, the creatine kinase, you can see, is hugely, hugely elevated from normal. So right away we know, okay, something's wrong. Now, is it the brain? Is it just muscle? Did he really just tear muscles? Or is it his heart? Then we go to looking at the fractions. Because remember, the MM is skeletal muscle, BB is brain, and MB is cardiac. So of course, when they saw this huge fraction of cardiac, they knew that his heart, the cardiac muscles, the cells, were lysing, spilling out their contents. They probably also, additional studies, of course, would look at lactate dehydrogenase and aspartate aminotransferase over the next couple days. Now they've clearly identified he is indeed having a heart attack, and they can then, of course, begin to treat it and hopefully reduce damage to the heart muscle and allow him to survive. So they're also going to look for the H4 isozyme for lactate dehydrogenase, and they're also going to look for aspartate aminotransferase. But remember, in the order in which these enzymes appear, the CPK, or as it's called here, CK, is the first one to appear. So it's the easiest one to look for if we're suspecting that the person might be having some kind of coronary event, which again is suspected because of the fact that he could not stop the pain. He's male. He's of the age when people start to think about that stuff. He's sweaty, diaphoretic, probably nauseated, all symptoms that the clinician starts to think, well, maybe. And so then they begin to check, and the very first thing you look for is the CPK or CK enzyme. And of course, in this case, it's present. So indeed, there is a heart attack going on here. I don't know.